That's right, I replied without laughing. I'll tell you a secret, but you must swear you'll never tell another soul.
I swear.
His father, I said, lowering my voice, got rid of all the worms in Chairman Mao's teeth. After a moment's respectful silence, she asked, If I got the sorceresses to come and keep a vigil by his son's sickbed tonight, would he mind? Towards midnight, four old crones arrived from three different villages. They wore trailing robes of black and blue, flowers in their hair, and jade bracelets on their wrists. The sorceresses huddled over Luo, who was twitching in his sleep. Then they settled down at the four corners of the bed and eyed him through the mosquito net. It was hard to say which of them was the most ugly and likely to frighten off evil spirits. One of the sorceresses, the most shriveled of all, held a bow and arrow in her hands.
I can guarantee, she said to me, that the evil spirit of the little coal mine, the one who's been plaguing your friend here, won't dare to come tonight. My bow is from Tibet, and my arrow is tipped with silver. When I shoot my arrow, it whistles in the air like a flying flute, and never fails to pierce the breast of demons, however powerful they may be.
Not only were the sorceresses very old, it was also very late, and after a while they began to yawn. And despite the strong tea our hostess plied them with, they nodded off, one after the other. The owner of the bow, too, succumbed to sleep. She laid the weapon on the bed, and her slack, painted lids drooped heavily and closed.
Wake them up, the little seamstress said to me. Tell them a film.
What kind?
Doesn't matter, just keep them awake.
So, I embarked on the strangest performance of my life. In that remote village, tucked into a cleft in the mountain, where my friend had fallen into a sort of stupor, I sat in the flickering light of an oil lamp and related the North Korean film for the benefit of a pretty girl and four ancient sorceresses. I got along on my own as best I could. After a few minutes, the audience was captivated by the story of the poor flower girl. They even asked questions, and the longer I spoke, the less they had to blink their eyes to stay awake. Still, the magic was not the same as when Luo took the lead. I was not a born storyteller. We were different. Half an hour into the story, the flower girl, having gone to extreme lengths to get some money, rushes to the hospital, only to find that she is too late. Her mother has died, calling desperately for her daughter in her last breath. A propaganda film like any other. Normally speaking, the deathbed scene marked the first high point in the story. The audience would always weep at this moment, regardless of whether they were watching the film or listening to our version of it. Perhaps the sorceresses were made of different stuff. They listened attentively, with some degree of engagement. I could even sense a slight frisson of emotion, but no tears were shed. Disappointed by the effect of my performance, I dwelt on the description of the flower girl's uncontrollably shaking hand and the banknotes slipping from her fingers. But the sorceresses were unimpressed. Suddenly, from inside the white mosquito net, came a voice that sounded as if it issued from the bottom of a well.
The saying goes, Luo intoned, that a sincere heart can make a stone blossom. So tell me, was the flower girl's heart lacking in sincerity?
I was struck more by the fact that Luo had uttered the resounding finale before the story had ended than by his sudden awakening. But what a surprise when I glanced around the room. The four sorceresses were weeping. Their tears spurted forth generously and coursed down their warped, fissured cheeks. How great Luo's talent was. He was able to electrify an audience by means of a perfectly timed voiceover, even when overcome by a violent bout of malaria. As I continued with the story, I had the impression there was something different about the little seamstress, and I realized that her hair was hanging loose in luxuriant tresses, a wonderful mane cascading over her shoulders. I guessed that Luo must have reached out of the mosquito net and untied her long pigtail with his feverish fingers. A sudden draft made the lamp sputter and die, and in that moment,
I thought I saw the little seamstress lift one corner of the net and bend over Luo in the dark for a furtive kiss. One of the sorceresses relit the oil lamp, and I went on to tell the rest of the Korean girl's sad story. The sorceresses wept profusely, their tears mingling with the phlegm running from their nostrils, and their snuffling continued until deep into the night. Part 2. Four Eyes had a secret suitcase, which he kept carefully hidden. He was our friend. Remember, we were on our way to see him when we had our encounter with a tailor on the mountain path. The village where Four Eyes was being re-educated was situated lower on the slopes of Phoenix Mountain than ours. Luo and I often went over to his house in the evening to cook a meal, if we had managed to lay hands on a bit of meat, a bottle of local liquor, or some fresh vegetables from the peasants' gardens. We would share our spoils as if we were a gang of three. This made it all the more surprising that he didn't breathe a word to us about his mysterious suitcase. His family lived in the same city as our parents. His father was a writer, his mother a poet. Recently disgraced by the authorities, they had burdened their beloved son with the same dreaded odds as Luo and I faced, the terrible 3 in 1,000. So we were all in the same boat, but Four Eyes, who was 18 years old at the time, lived in almost perpetual fear. In his presence, everything became tinged with danger. At his house, we felt like three criminals huddling conspiratorially around the oil lamp. Take the meal, for instance. A knock on the door while we were wreathed in the delicious aromas of some meat dish we had prepared, cooking smells that plunged the three of us, famished, into a frenzy of anticipation, was enough to frighten him out of his wits. He would spring to his feet, quickly hide the pan in a corner as if it were contraband, and put out a dish of marinated vegetables, mushy and repulsive, in its stead. Eating meat struck him a crime typical of the bourgeois class to which his family belonged. The day after my performance for the four sorceresses, Luo felt a little better. He was well enough to go home, he said, and the little seamstress didn't insist on our staying. I imagine she was exhausted. After breakfast, we set off along the lonely mountain footpath. The damp morning air felt pleasantly refreshing on our flushed faces. Luo smoked as he walked. At first the path descended a little way, then it rose again. When it got steep, I took my sick friend's arm. The ground was soft and wet. The trees intertwined their branches overhead. Passing the village where Four Eyes lived, we spotted him at work in a paddy field. He was tilling the soil with the aid of a plow and a water buffalo. We could not see the furrows he was making because the thick, fertile bed was flooded with flat water. Bare from the waist up, our friend was making slow progress, for with each step he sank down to his knees in the thick mud while the black buffalo strained at the plow. The slanting rays of the early morning sun glinted off his spectacles. The buffalo was of medium size, but boasted an exceptionally long tail, which it swung vigorously from side to side as though determined to splatter its timid, inexperienced master with as much filth as possible. For all his efforts to dodge the relentless lashes, one split second of inattention was enough for Four Eyes to receive a blow to the face from the buffalo's tail, which sent his spectacles hurtling through the air. He swore and dropped the reins from his right hand and the plow from his left. Clapping his hands over his eyes, he let out a stream of abuse as if he had been blinded. He was so enraged that he didn't hear our jovial shouts of greeting. He was very short-sighted and was unable to distinguish us from the jeering peasants in the neighboring paddy fields. He bent over and plunged his arms into the water, groping around in the mud. The blank expression in his bulging eyes was disconcerting. Four Eyes had evidently aroused his buffalo's sadistic instinct. The creature halted, then heaved from side to side, trampling the muddy bed with vigor, as though intent upon crushing the submerged spectacles with its hooves or the lurching plowshare. I took off my shoes, rolled up my trousers, and stepped into the paddy field, leaving Luo seated by the wayside. Four Eyes was not eager for me to help search for his spectacles, fearing that I would be a hindrance, but in the end it was I who stepped on them inadvertently as I groped in the mud. Fortunately, they were still in one piece. His vision restored to its former clarity, Four Eyes was shocked to see the state Luo was in.
"You look sick as a dog," he said.
As Four Eyes couldn't abandon his work, he suggested we go to his place and take a rest until he returned. He was lodged in the center of the village. He had few personal belongings and was so anxious to demonstrate his complete trust in the revolutionary peasants that he never used to lock his door. The building, an old grain storehouse, was on stilts like ours, but it had a projecting porch supported by sturdy bamboo stakes where cereals, vegetables, and spices would be spread out to dry. Luo and I settled down on the porch to enjoy the sunshine. After a time, the sun slid behind a mountain peak, and there was a chill in the air. Once the sweat on Luo's body had dried, he turned ice cold. I found an old pullover belonging to Four Eyes and draped it over his back, tying the sleeves around his neck like a scarf. Even though the sun reappeared, he continued to complain of the cold. I went inside again to fetch a quilt from the bed, and on my way there, it occurred to me that there might be another pullover lying around somewhere. I took a look under the bed, where I discovered a large wooden packing crate. Piled on top was a jumble of old shoes and broken slippers encrusted with mud and dirt. Pulling the crate into a beam of dust-dappled sunlight, I opened it and found that it contained more articles of clothing. I was fumbling around in the hope of finding a small pullover that would fit Luo's scrawny body when my fingers suddenly came upon something soft, supple, and smooth to the touch, which made me think at once of a lady's doeskin shoe. But it was not a shoe. It was a suitcase. A ray of light bounced off the glossy lid. It was an elegant suitcase, a little worn, but made of fine leather, and it gave off a whiff of civilization. It seemed inordinately heavy in relation to its size, but I had no way of telling what was inside. It was fastened with locks in three places. I waited impatiently for the evening, when Four Eyes would be released from his daily struggle with the buffalo, so that I could ask him what sort of treasure he had so securely hidden away in his secret cache. To my surprise, he didn't answer my question. All the time we were cooking, he was unusually quiet, and when he did speak, he took care not to mention the suitcase. While we were eating our supper, I broached the subject again, but still he said nothing. Luo broke the silence.
"I expect they're books," he said. "The way you keep your suitcase locked up and hidden away is enough to betray your secret. You've got a stash of forbidden books."
A flicker of panic showed in our short-sighted friend's eyes, then vanished behind his glasses as he composed his features into a smiling mask.
"You must be dreaming," he said.
He reached out to touch Luo's forehead.
"Good God! Such a fever! That's what's giving you these crazy ideas! It's making you delirious! Listen, we're all friends. We have some good times together, which is fine. But if you go on about such rubbish as forbidden books, damn it, then..."
Soon afterwards, Four Eyes bought a brass padlock from one of his neighbors, and from then on he always took the precaution of securing the door of his house with a chain. 2 weeks later, the broken bowl shards gathered by the little seamstress proved effective, and Luo's malaria subsided. When he removed the bandage from his wrist, he discovered a blister the size of a bird's egg, shiny and transparent. It shrank eventually until there was only a small black scar left, and the bouts of fever stopped altogether. We cooked a meal at Four Eyes' house to celebrate Luo's recovery. That night, all three of us slept tightly packed in his bed. When I checked the space underneath, I found that the crate was still there, but the leather suitcase had gone. The heightened vigilance and distrust shown by Four Eyes, in spite of the friendship between us, seemed to substantiate Luo's theory, and we grew convinced that the suitcase was indeed filled with banned books. We often discussed this between us, Luo and I, speculating wildly about the kind of books that might be among them. At the time, no books were permitted at all, the only exceptions being those written by Mao or his cronies and purely scientific works. We compiled a long list of possible titles, a whole range of Chinese classics from the Romance of the Three Kingdoms to the Dream of the Red Chamber and the Jin Ping Mei, which was reputed to be an erotic book. Also on our list was the poetry of the Tang, Song, Ming, and Qing dynasties, and the work of traditional artists such as Zhu Da, Shi Tao, Dong Qichang. We even thought of including the Bible, as well as the words of the five ancients, which had allegedly been forbidden for centuries, and in which five great prophets of the Han dynasty revealed, from the summit of a sacred mountain, what the next 2,000 years would bring. Often, after extinguishing the oil lamp in our house on stilts, we would lie on our beds and smoke in the dark. Book titles poured from our lips, the mysterious and exotic names evoking unknown worlds. It was like Tibetan incense, where you need only say the name, Zhangxiang, to smell the subtle, refined fragrance and to see the joystick sweating beads of scented moisture, which, in the lamplight, resemble drops of liquid gold.
"What have you heard about Western literature?"
Luo asked me one day. "Not much. You know, my parents were only interested in their work. Aside from medicine, they didn't know very much."
"It was the same with mine. But one of my aunts had a few foreign books in Chinese translation. That was before the Cultural Revolution. I remember her reading to me from a book called Don Quixote. It was about an old knight-errant, and it was a great story."
"What happened to her books?"
"They went up in smoke, confiscated by the Red Guards, who promptly burned them in public right in front of her apartment building."
For the next few minutes, we puffed on our cigarettes in the dark, despondently and without speaking. All this talk of literature was getting me down. We had been so unlucky. By the time we had finally learned to read properly, there had been nothing left for us to read. For years, the Western literature sections of the bookshops were devoted to the complete works of the Albanian communist leader Enver Hoxha. Volume after volume with gilded bindings bearing the portrait of an old man with a garish tie, impeccably groomed gray hair, and steely hooded eyes. The left one brown, the right one slightly smaller and of a paler shade of brown turning pinkish toward the rim.
"What made you think of Western literature?" I asked Luo.
"Well, I was just wondering. That might well be what Four Eyes has got in his leather suitcase."
"You may be right. What with his father being a writer and his mother a poet, they must have had plenty of books at home, just as there were lots of books about Western medicine in your house and mine. But how on earth could a whole caseful have escaped the notice of the Red Guards?"
"Perhaps his parents had the sense to hide them in time."
"They took the devil of a risk entrusting them to Four Eyes."
"Just as your parents and mine always dreamed that we'd be doctors like them, Four Eyes' parents probably wanted their son to be a writer. They must have thought it would be good for him to read books, even if he had to do so in secret."
One cold morning in early spring, snowflakes fell thick and fast for 2 hours, and soon the ground was blanketed with 10 centimeters of fluffy snow. The village headman gave us the day off. Luo and I set out at once to visit Four Eyes. We had heard about his stroke of bad luck. As was bound to happen, the lenses of his spectacles had been broken. I was sure, however, that he wouldn't allow this mishap to interfere with his work, in case his myopia was taken as a sign of physical deficiency by the revolutionary peasants, and they thought he was a slacker. He lived in constant terror of the peasants' opinion, for it would be up to them one day to decide whether he had been properly re-educated, and so, in theory at any rate, his future lay in their hands. In these circumstances, even the slightest defect, either political or physical, could be disastrous. Unlike us, the inhabitants of our friend's village had to carry on working in spite of the snow. Great hodfuls of rice needed to be transported on foot to the district storage station, which was situated 20 kilometers away on the bank of a river whose source was in Tibet. It was time for the annual village tax contribution, and the headman had divided the total weight of rice by the number of villagers, each one being charged with carrying about 60 kilos. We arrived to find Four Eyes filling his hod in readiness for the journey to the rice station. We threw some snowballs at him, but he looked all round without seeing us. Without his spectacles, his goggle eyes reminded me of the dull, dazed look of a Pekingese dog. He seemed quite lost and stricken, even before he had hoisted the hod of rice onto his back.
"You're mad," Luo said to him. "Without your glasses, you won't be able to manage that mountain path."
"I've written to my mother. She's going to send me a new pair as soon as possible, but I can't sit and do nothing until they arrive. I've got to work. That's what I'm here for. At least that's what the headman says."
He talked very rapidly, as if he had no time to waste on us.
"Wait," Luo said. "I've got an idea. We'll help you carry your hod to the rice station, and when we get back, you can lend us some of those books you've got hidden in your suitcase. How's that for a deal?"
"To hell with you," growled Four Eyes. "I don't know what you're talking about. I haven't got any books hidden away." Spluttering with anger, he hoisted the heavy burden onto his back and set off.
"Just one book will do," Luo called after him. "Done?"
Without replying, Four Eyes pressed on. The physical odds were against him. Very soon he was embroiled in a sort of masochistic ordeal. The snow made the path more slippery than usual, and in some places, he sank into it up to his ankles. He kept his bulging eyes fixed on the ground before him, but couldn't see the raised stones on which he might have put his feet. He advanced blindly, tottering and lurching like a drunkard. At one point where the path fell away, he extended a leg in search of a foothold, but his other leg, unable to sustain the weight of the hod on his back, buckled, and he fell to his knees. He tried to plow on in this position, without upsetting the hod on his back, scooping the snow away with his hands so as to clear a path for himself, meter by meter, until he managed to scramble to his feet again. From afar we watched him zigzag down the path, only to lose his footing again some minutes later. This time, the hod knocked against a rock as he fell, causing the contents to spill out. We went down the path to help him collect the spilled rice. None of us spoke. I didn't dare look him in the eye. He sat back, pulled off his snow-filled boots, emptied them, and then set about warming his swollen feet by rubbing them hard between his hands. His head kept lolling from side to side, as if it had become too heavy for his neck. "Got a headache?" I asked him. "No, it's my ears that are buzzing. I'll be all right." By the time we had finished putting all the rice back into the hod, the sleeves of my coat were encrusted with snow crystals. "Shall we take over?" I asked Luo. "Yes. Give me a hand with the hod, will you?" he said. "I feel cold, and some weight on my back will warm me up." Luo and I took turns every 50 meters or so to carry the 60 kilos of rice. When we arrived at the storage station, we were utterly exhausted. On our return, Four Eyes gave us a book. A thin, worn volume. The author's name was Balzac. Ba Er Sarke. Translated into Chinese, the name of the French author comprised four ideograms. The magic of translation. The ponderousness of the two syllables, as well as the belligerent, somewhat old-fashioned ring of the name, were quite gone, now that the four characters, very elegant, each composed of just a few strokes, banded together to create an unusual beauty, redolent with an exotic fragrance as sensual as the perfume wreathing a wine stored for centuries in a cellar. Years later, I learned that the translator was himself a great writer. Having been forbidden to publish his own works for political reasons, he spent the rest of his life translating French novels. Did Four Eyes stop to think about which book he would lend us, or was it a random choice? Perhaps he picked it simply because, of all the treasures in his precious suitcase, it was the thinnest book and the most decrepit. Did he have ulterior motives which we could not fathom? Whatever his reasons, his choice was to have a profound effect on our lives. The slim little volume was entitled Ursule Mirouet. Luo started reading the book the very same night that Four Eyes lent it to us, and reached the end at dawn, when he put out the oil lamp and passed the book to me. I stayed in bed until nightfall, without food, completely wrapped up in the French story of love and miracles. Picture, if you will, a boy of 19, still slumbering in the limbo of adolescence, having heard nothing but revolutionary blather about patriotism, communism, ideology, and propaganda all his life, falling headlong into a story of awakening desire, passion, impulsive action, love of all the subjects that had, until then, been hidden from me. In spite of my complete ignorance of that distant land called France, I had heard Napoleon mentioned by my father a few times, that was all. Ursule's story rang as true as if it had been about my neighbors. The messy affair over inheritance and money that befell her made the story all the more convincing, thereby enhancing the power of the words. By the end of the day, I was feeling quite at home in Nemours, imagining myself posted by the smoking hearth of her parlor in the company of doctors and curates. Even the part about magnetism and somnambulism struck me as credible and riveting. I did not rise from my bed until I had turned the last page. Luo had not yet returned. There had been no doubt in my mind when he set off on the mountain path at first light. He had gone to visit the little seamstress so he could tell her this wonderful tale of Balzac's. I stood on the threshold of our house on stilts for some time, munching a piece of cornbread as I contemplated the somber silhouette of the mountain peak looming ahead. The village where the little seamstress lived was too far away for the lights in the house to be visible, but in my mind's eye, I could see Luo telling her the story. Suddenly, I felt a stab of jealousy, a bitter, wrenching emotion I had never felt before. It was chilly, and I shivered in my short sheepskin coat. The villagers ate, slept, or went about their private business in the dusk, but in front of our house on stilts, everything was quiet. Usually I took advantage of the calm raining on the mountain at this hour to practice my violin, but now it seemed a depressing thing to do. I stepped inside and picked up my instrument, but when I played it, the sound was shrill and disagreeable, as if I had forgotten how to play. Then I was seized with an idea. I would copy out my favorite passages from Ursule Miroe, word for word. It was the first time in my life that I had felt any desire to copy sentences from a book. I ransacked the room for paper, but all I could find was a few sheets of notepaper intended for letters to our parents. I decided I would write directly onto the inside of my sheepskin coat. The short coat, a gift from the villagers when I arrived, was made of skins with wool of varying lengths and textures on the outside and bare hide on the inside. It was hard to find suitable passages in the book, as the limited space afforded by my coat was further reduced by areas where the leather was too cracked to be of use. I copied out the chapter where Ursule somnambulates. I longed to be like her, to be able, while I lay asleep on my bed, to see what my mother was doing in our apartment 500 kilometers away, to watch my parents having supper, to observe their gestures, the dishes on the table, the color of the crockery, to sniff the aroma of their food, to hear their conversation. Better still, like Ursule, I would visit in my dreams places I had never set eyes on before. Riding on the skin of an old mountain sheep was not easy. The surface was rough and creased, and in order to squeeze as much text as possible into the available space, I had to use a minute script, which required all the concentration I could muster. By the time I had covered the entire inside of the jacket, including the sleeves, my fingers were aching so badly it felt as if the bones were broken. At last, I dozed off. The sound of Luo's footsteps woke me. It was 3 a.m. I couldn't have been asleep for long, as the oil lamp was still alight. I saw his shadowy figure slip into the room.
Are you asleep?
Not really.
I've got something to show you.
He topped up the lamp with oil, and when the wick was burning brightly, he took the lamp in his left hand, came over to my bed, and sat down on the edge. His eyes were blazing, and his hair was rumpled. From the pocket of his jacket, he drew a square of neatly folded white cloth. I see. The little seamstress has given you a handkerchief. He didn't reply. As he slowly unfolded the cloth, I saw that it was torn from a shirt that had undoubtedly belonged to the little seamstress. It had a patch sewn on by hand. Inside were some dried leaves. They all had the same pretty shape, like butterfly wings, in shades ranging from deep orange to brown, streaked with pale gold. But all of them were stained black, with blood.
"They're the leaves of a ginkgo tree," Luo said breathlessly. "A magnificent, towering tree that grows in a secret valley to the east of the little seamstress's village. We made love there, against the trunk, standing. She was a virgin, and her blood dripped onto the leaves scattered underneath." Words failed me. I strained to imagine the scene. The tree, the nobility of its trunk, the grandeur of its branches, the carpet of butterfly leaves. And then I asked him, "Standing?" "Yes, like horses." Perhaps that's why she laughed afterwards, a laugh so piercing, so wild, and echoing so far and wide that even the birds took wing in fright. Once our eyes had been opened, we kept our promise and returned Ursule Miroe to her rightful owner, Four Eyes, or rather, Two Eyes now that he was bereft of his glasses. We were under the illusion that he would lend us more books from his secret suitcase in exchange for jobs we would do for him while he was incapacitated by poor eyesight. But he wouldn't hear of it. We often went to his house to take him food, entertain him, play the violin for him. Eventually, the arrival of his new glasses, sent by his mother, delivered him from his semi-blindness and put an end to our hopes for the time being. We bitterly regretted having returned the book.
We should never have given it back, Luo said repeatedly. I could have read it out, page by page, to the little seamstress. That would have made her more refined, more cultured, I'm quite sure.
It was, so he maintained, the extract copied onto the inside of my coat that had given him this idea. Luo and I were in the habit of sharing our clothes, and on one occasion, it was a day of rest, he borrowed my sheepskin coat to wear when he went to meet the little seamstress at the foot of their ginkgo tree in the Valley of Love.
After I had read the passage from Balzac to her word for word, he explained, she took your coat and reread the whole thing in silence. The only sounds were the leaves rustling overhead and the faint rush of a distant waterfall. It was a beautiful day. The sky was a heavenly blue, blissful and clear. When she'd finished reading, she sat there quite still, open-mouthed.
Your coat was resting on the flat of her hands, the way a sacred object lies in the palms of the pious.
This fellow, Balzac, is a wizard, he went on.
He touched the head of this mountain girl with an invisible finger, and she was transformed, carried away in a dream. It took a while for her to come down to earth. She ended up putting your wretched coat on, which looked very good on her, I must say. She said having Balzac's words next to her skin made her feel good, and also more intelligent. The enthusiasm of the little seamstress's response made us feel even worse about having returned the book. Indeed, we had to wait until the early summer for a fresh opportunity to arise. It was Sunday. Four Eyes had made a fire in his yard to heat a cauldron of water which was raised up on a couple of stones. Luo and I were surprised to see him so busy around the house. At first he didn't talk to us at all. He seemed weary and dejected. When the water boiled, he took off his jacket with a look of distaste, dropped it in the cauldron, and held it down with the aid of a long stick. Wreathed in thick steam, he kept stirring his miserable jacket around while little black bubbles, crumbs of tobacco, and a fetid smell rose to the surface.
Is it to kill the lice? I asked him.
Yes. I got covered in them on the 1,000-meter cliff.
We had heard about this cliff, but had never set foot there ourselves. It was quite far from our village, half a day's march at least.
What were you doing there?
He didn't reply. Methodically, he stripped off his shirt, vest, trousers and socks, and plunged them in the boiling water. His thin, bony body was dotted all over with angry red bumps, and the skin was broken and bleeding and covered in scratch marks.
They're huge, the lice on that god-awful cliff. They even managed to lay their eggs in the seams of my clothes,
Four Eyes told us. He went into the house to fetch his underpants, which he held out to us before dropping them into the cauldron.
God almighty! Lining the seams, there were rows and rows of black eggs, gleaming like tiny glass beads. Just glimpsing them was enough to give me goose flesh from head to toe.
Luo and I sat side by side tending the fire, while Four Eyes stood over the cauldron stirring the clothes with his long wooden stick. Little by little he revealed to us the secret behind his journey to the 1,000-meter cliff. 2 weeks earlier he had received a letter from his mother, the poetess who had once been famous in our province for her odes on mist, rain, and the blushing memory of first love. She informed him that an old friend of hers had been appointed editor-in-chief of a journal devoted to revolutionary literature, and that he had promised, despite his precarious situation, to try to find a position at the journal for her son. To avoid any semblance of favoritism, he suggested that he publish in his journal the words to a number of popular ballads, that is to say, sincere, authentic folk songs, full of romantic realism, which Four Eyes would collect from the peasants on the mountain. After receiving this news, Four Eyes walked on air. He felt completely changed. For the first time in his life, he was suffused with happiness. He refused to go out to work in the fields. Instead, he threw himself heart and soul into the solitary search for mountain folk songs. He was confident that he would succeed in assembling a vast collection, which would enable his mother's former admirer to keep his promise. But a whole week passed without him coming up with a single song line worthy of publication in an official journal. Weeping tears of frustration, he had written to his mother telling her of his predicament. He had been on the point of handing the sealed envelope to the postman when the latter mentioned an old man who lived on the 1,000-meter cliff. This old man, a poor miller, knew all the songs of the region, and although illiterate, he had the reputation of being a champion singer. Four Eyes had torn up his letter to his mother on the spot and had quickly set off on a fresh expedition.
"The old man's a drunkard, and he's very poor," he told us. "I've never seen anyone as poor in my life. Do you know what he takes with his liquor? Pebbles. I swear, it's true, on the head of my mother. He dips them in salty water, puts them in his mouth, rolls them around, and spits them out again. He says this dish is called jade dumplings with miller sauce. He offered some to me, but I declined. I didn't realize I'd be hurting his feelings, but after that he became very irritated. I tried desperately to persuade him to sing for me, even offering him money, but he clammed up completely. I stayed with him at the old mill for 2 days in the hope of drawing him out, and I spent the night in his bed, rolled up in a quilt that can't have been washed for decades."
It was not hard to imagine the scene. The bug-infested bed upon which Four Eyes lay, fighting to stay awake in case the old man happened to sing snatches of sincere, authentic folk songs in his sleep, while the lice swarmed out of their hiding places to attack in the dark, sucking his blood, skating on the slippery lenses of his spectacles, which he hadn't removed for the night. At the slightest twitch of the old man's body, at the faintest grunt, our friend Four Eyes would hold his breath, ready to switch on his pocket torch and take notes like a spy. But after a brief moment of suspense, everything would return to normal, with the old man snoring regularly to the rhythm of the never-ending water wheel.
"I've got an idea," Luo said casually. "If we were to succeed in getting your miller to sing his folk songs to us, would you lend us some more books by Balzac?"
Four Eyes didn't answer at once. He focused his steamed-up glasses on the black water bubbling in the cauldron, as though hypnotized by the dead lice somersaulting among the bubbles and tobacco flakes. Finally, he raised his head and asked Luo, "How do you propose to go about it?"
Had you seen me on my way to the 1,000-meter cliff that summer's day in 1973, you would have sworn I had stepped out of an official photograph of a Communist Party conference, or out of the wedding portrait of a revolutionary cadre. I wore a navy blue jacket with a dark gray collar made for me by the little seamstress. It was an exact copy of the jacket worn by Chairman Mao, from the collar down to the shape of the pockets and the trimmings on the sleeves, a trio of little brass buttons that caught the light every time I moved my arms. Seeking to disguise the youthfulness of my unruly hair, which stood out from my scalp, our wardrobe mistress had covered my head with an old green cap, like an army officer's, which belonged to her father. Unfortunately, it was at least one size too small for me. As for Luo, in keeping with his secretarial status, he wore a faded army uniform, which we had borrowed the day before from a young peasant recently returned from military service. On his chest shone a fiery red badge with Mao's head in gold relief, his hair solidly slicked back. As we had never ventured into this wild and forsaken part of the mountain before, we very nearly lost our way in a dense forest of bamboo. The giant grasses glistening with raindrops towered all around, their tufted crowns meeting overhead and closing in on us. There was an acrid smell of invisible animals, and now and then you could hear the soft thrust of new growth and unfurling shoots. The more vigorous species of bamboo can, it seems, grow as much as 30 centimeters in a single day. The old singer's watermill straddled a torrent that fell from a tall cliff. It was like a relic from the past, with its enormous wheels of white stone veined with black, turning at an appropriately measured, rural sort of pace. Inside, on the ground floor, the wooden planking shook. Looking down through the gaps between the ancient warped floorboards, you could see the water rushing between large rocks. The crunching sound of stone turning on stone reverberated in our ears. An old man, naked from the waist up, stood in the middle of the room, pouring grain into the milling hole. He interrupted his work when we came in and eyed us with suspicion, saying nothing. I greeted him, not in the Sichuan dialect of our province, but in Mandarin, as if I were an actor in a film.
"What language is he speaking?"
the old man asked Luo, puzzled.
"The official language," replied Luo. "The language of Beijing. Don't you speak Mandarin?"
Where's Beijing?
We were taken aback by his question. But when we realized he was speaking in earnest, we couldn't help laughing. For a moment, I almost envied him his complete ignorance of the outside world.
Beiping, does that ring a bell?
Luo asked.
Beiping?
The old man said.
Certainly, it's the big city in the north.
They changed the name 20 years ago, little father, Luo explained. And this gentleman here, he speaks the official language of Beiping, as you call it.
The old man threw me a look of deep respect. He stared at my Mao jacket, then fixed his eyes on the trio of buttons on the sleeves. He reached out to touch them with the tips of his fingers.
Such pretty little things. What are they for?
He asked. Luo translated his question for me. I replied in my shaky Mandarin that I didn't know. But my interpreter told the old miller that I had said they were the mark of a real revolutionary cadre.
This gentleman, Luo went on in his suave con man voice, has come all the way from Beijing for the purpose of collecting the folk songs of this region, and every citizen who knows any is duty-bound to pass them on to him.
Our mountain songs?
The old man asked, glancing suspiciously in my direction.
They're not proper songs, you know. They're just ditties, old ditties.
What this gentleman is looking for is precisely that. The authentic, robustly primitive words of ancient ditties.
The old miller mulled over this very precise request. Then he grinned at me with a strange, crafty glint in his eyes.
Do you honestly think?
Yes, I do, I replied firmly.
Does the gentleman really wish me to sing that kind of rude nonsense for him? Because, you see, our ditties, as everybody knows, are...
He was interrupted by the arrival of a party of peasants carrying heavy burdens on their backs. I was very worried indeed, as was my so-called interpreter. I whispered in his ear, "Shall we make a run for it?" But the old man, turning to us, asked Luo,
"What's he saying?"
Whereupon I felt myself blush, and to hide my embarrassment, I quickly went to offer the peasants some help with unloading their burdens. There were 6 of them. Not one had ever been to our village, it seemed, and once I had made sure they had no idea who we were, I felt better. They deposited their heavy cargoes of maize for milling on the ground.
Come along now. Let me introduce you to this young gentleman from Beiping,
the old miller told the peasants.
See the 3 little buttons on his sleeves?
Transformed, radiant, the old hermit took my wrist, raised it in the air, and waved it to and fro in front of the peasants for them to admire the silly yellow buttons.
You know what they are?
He cried, liquor squirting from his mouth.
They're the mark of a revolutionary cadre.
I was amazed at the strength in this scrawny old man's calloused hand. His vice-like grip on my wrist almost cracked the bone. Con man Luo stood next to us, translating the miller's words into Mandarin, with all the serious air of an official interpreter. I found myself nodding and shaking hands with everyone like some political leader in a newsreel, while I stammered civilities in very poor Mandarin indeed. Never in my life had I behaved in this way. I regretted this incognito visit, rashly undertaken to accomplish an impossible mission on behalf of Four Eyes, cruel master of the leather suitcase. I nodded my head so energetically that my green cap, or rather the tailor's cap, fell to the ground. The peasants went away, at long last, leaving behind a mountain of maize for grinding. I felt utterly drained, and my head was aching badly from the tight-fitting cap, which felt more and more like a metal clamp on my skull. The old miller led us up a shaky wooden ladder, from which 2 or 3 rungs were missing, to the next floor. There he hurried over to a rattan basket and drew out a calabash filled with liquor and 3 small beakers.
It's not so dusty here, he said, grinning. Let's have a drink.
The floor of this large, dimly lit space was scattered with pebbles, which we suspected were the jade dumplings Four Eyes had told us about. Like downstairs, there was not a stick of furniture except for a large bed. On the wall hung the dark, dappled skin of a leopard or panther and a musical instrument, a sort of bamboo viol with three strings. The old miller invited us to sit down on his bed. It was the very bed to which Four Eyes owed his painful memories. I glanced at my interpreter, who was clearly just as apprehensive as I was.
"Wouldn't it be more pleasant to sit outside?" faltered Luo, his nerves beginning to fray. "It's so dark in here."
"Don't worry, I'll take care of that."
The old man lit an oil lamp and put it down in the middle of the bed. The reservoir was nearly empty, so he went off in search of fuel. He returned the next minute with a calabash full of oil. He poured some into the lamp and placed the half-full calabash next to the one containing the liquor. Huddled around the oil lamp, we squatted on the bed and drank. Right next to me was a bundle of soiled clothes rolled up in a spare blanket. As I sipped my drink, I could feel tiny insects crawling up one of my legs. I decided to waive the protocol of my official status and slip my hand discreetly into my trousers, but immediately felt my other leg being attacked. I had a vision of my body as a rallying ground for armies of lice, all thrilled at the change of diet, ravenous for the delights offered by my poor veins. I had a vision of Four Eyes stirring the big cauldron in which clothes billowed and sank and whirled, only it was my new mouse-style jacket seething amid the black bubbles. After a while, the old miller went away, leaving us at the mercy of the lice. He returned with a platter, a small bowl, and three pairs of chopsticks, all of which he put out on the quilt next to the lamp. Then he clambered onto the bed again. Neither Luo nor I had thought for a moment that the old man would have the gall to make us the same offer as he had made Four Eyes. But it was too late to distract him. The platter was heaped with small, ordinary-looking pebbles in varying shades of gray and green, and the bowl contained clear water which sparkled in the light of the oil lamp. The salt crystals lying on the bottom told us that this must be the miller's sauce. Meanwhile, my attackers were reaching the limits of their territorial expansion. They had got under my cap, and I could feel my hair standing on end as they raided my scalp.
"Help yourselves," the old man told us. "It's my usual fare, jade dumplings with salty sauce."
He took his chopsticks, picked up a pebble from the dish, and slowly dipped it in the sauce as if performing a ritual. Then he raised the pebble to his lips and sucked it with relish. He kept it in his mouth for a long time. I saw it roll around between his rotten teeth, but just as he seemed about to swallow it, it reemerged from the depths of his throat. The old man pursed his lips and spat it out of the corner of his mouth, making it skitter across the floor. After a moment's hesitation, Luo took up his chopsticks and tasted his first jade dumpling, wearing an expression of polite approval mixed with pity. The visitor from Bai Ping, as I pretended to be, followed suit. The sauce was not too salty, and the pebble left a sour, sweet taste in my mouth. The old man kept refilling our beakers with liquor and pressing us to join him in yet another toast. Our three mouths sent the pebbles flying through the air in an arc. Some of them struck other pebbles already strewn on the floor, making a sharp, jolly clatter. The old man was in excellent spirits. He also had a sense of occasion. Before embarking on his mountain ditties, he went down to stop the grindstone turning, as it made too much noise. Then he went over to the window and shut it, in order to improve the acoustics. He was still naked to the waist, and he adjusted his belt of plaited straw with care before unhooking his three-stringed instrument from the wall.
"So, you want to hear some old songs?" he offered.
"Indeed we do. It's for an important official journal," Luo said in a confidential tone. "We're counting on you, old man. What we need are sincere, authentic songs with a touch of romantic realism."
"What do you mean by romantic?"
Luo pondered the question, then placed his hand on his chest, as though bearing witness before a heavenly power.
"Emotion and love."
The old man ran his fingers lightly over the strings of his instrument, which he held like a guitar. After a few notes, he launched, almost inaudibly, into song. Our attention was immediately drawn to the contortions of his stomach, the sight of which was so extraordinary as to obliterate his voice,
the tune, and everything else from our consciousness. Being so thin, he didn't actually have a stomach at all, just wrinkled skin forming innumerable tiny folds on his abdomen. When he began to sing, the wrinkles billowed out, forming little waves that rippled across his tanned and gleaming body. The band of plaited straw that served as his belt began to undulate too. Every now and then, it disappeared into a roll of skin. But just as it seemed lost forever in the tidal flow, it reemerged, dignified and pristine. A magical waistband. The old miller's voice, at once hoarse and deep, got louder and louder. While he sang, his eyes flitted incessantly from Luo's face to mine and back again, his expression veering from genial complicity to a wild stare. This is what he sang. Tell me, an old louse, what does it fear? It fears boiling water, boiling, bubbling water. And the young nun, tell me, what does she fear? She fears the old monk. No more and no less. Just the old monk. We held our sides laughing. We tried to control ourselves, of course, but the giggles inside us mounted and mounted until we exploded. The old miller smiled too and went on singing while the skin eddied across his stomach. Luo and I rolled over the ground in a paroxysm of hilarity. Wiping his eyes, Luo stood up. He took the calabash and filled our three beakers while we waited for the old singer to sing the rest of this sincere, authentic, romantic mountain song.
Let's drink to your incredible stomach, Luo proposed.
Waving his beaker, our singer invited us to lay our hands on his abdomen. He began taking deep breaths without singing, just for the fun of setting off the spectacular ripples across his stomach. Then we clinked our beakers and each of us gulped down the contents. For a few seconds, the three of us sat there, transfixed. Then suddenly my gorge rose with a taste so vile that I forgot my role and blurted in the broad dialect of Szechuan.
What's your moonshine made of?
No sooner had I asked the question than all three of us spat out what we had in our mouths, almost in unison. Luo had picked the wrong calabash. He hadn't poured us a drink of liquor, but lamp oil. I think it must have been the first time since his arrival on Phoenix Mountain that Four Eyes actually beamed at anyone with deep contentment. It was hot. His face was dripping with perspiration and his glasses kept slithering down his small nose. While he pored over the pieces of paper stained with salt, liquor, and lamp oil on which we had noted down the old miller's